Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's episode 703 of the Short Time Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jason Bryan, Hall of Fame wrestling writer, announcer, and broadcaster. And I'm going to bring you news, reviews, previews, and interviews from in and around the sport of wrestling. Today, talking with J.D. Oliva, wrestling coach at DeKalb up in Illinois. He's got a pretty good team up there. But we're not really talking about his team as much today, although they did have a really, really good season. You can check out the Illinois websites on that one. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about the crossover between professional wrestling and the collegiate world and the Olympic world. We're going to have a deep dive into that a little bit. And we're also going to talk to JD about his new books coming out. He's a novelist, a fiction writer, and we get into the weeds about writing, developing fiction stories, something that's a little different from a personality in wrestling, from somebody that gives their life to the sport, but also has interests outside of wrestling. You know, my interests, of course, involve collecting hats, craft beer, random sports facts about obscure basketball leagues and football leagues from the 70s, like the World Football League. Although I did just pick up a USFL hat, as we have a rekindled version of the high-flying 80s spring football league, the USFL. Had to buy the Tampa Bay Bandits hat because I have a Tampa Bay Bandits pennant here in the speakeasy, also the Jacksonville Bulls pennant as well. I got a Michigan Panthers one I've been meaning to send up to either Tommy Bloodround or Kevin Clonch, and I sent an Oklahoma Outlaws one over to Richard Immel, who lives about 15 minutes from me here in Minnesota. Again, today on the show, J.D. Oliva, we're talking things that don't necessarily deal with the sport of wrestling, but they have wrestling ties. They involve wrestlers. If you grew up in the 80s and you're a fan of pro wrestling or were a fan, we can talk to you about what's going on then more so than what's going on now. So got some references, of course, to Chaz Betts and, you know, or is his name now Chad Gable. Also got some references to Gable Steveson and, of course, Magnum T.A. from 80s NWA Crockett Country fame. So I'm going to talk to that. Before we get to that, also want to let you know that you can contribute to this network and its resources that we're putting out there for the wrestling community. I do a lot of stats, a lot of sandbox type of stuff, as I call it, a lot of background, a lot of research. And to put those stats together, that takes time. And your support helps me basically justify that time. You can do that at matttalkonline.com/contribute. And if you are a $10 a month or more subscriber on the Patreon side of things, you get access to that sandbox. I've got a private website with some logins and stuff, and you can actually dig deep into the data that I'm collecting as I go. Again, one of the things that I've been working on for the last couple of years is chronicling the history of the sport. When I say history of the sport, I mean the numbers of teams that existed, because all the time we have people, oh, we had 700 teams or whatever. Well, I'm trying to put an actual number up through 1981-82 is when the NCAA started tracking participation stats for men's and women's sports. So from the beginning of time, from those first 1928 seasons to when we have like guides from the NCAA that the Hall of Fame has on their website and PDFs, to the bound copies or the loose copies of amateur wrestling news I have behind me and various brackets in between, there's a number of teams that are wrestling each year. Now, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where college sports was kind of loose, you'd see a team pop up here, pop up there. What is considered a dropped program? What are the reasons for these dropped programs? All of these things are part of this, like this lifelong journey to basically chronicle the sport's history in ways that have not been done before. So part of that is where your contribution goes. Again, matchtalkonline.com/contribute. That'll give you the Rockfin, the Patreon, the Venmo, the Buy Me a Coffee, the PayPal, however you want to contribute to it. If you just want to say thank you, you're not interested in the gear, whatever, I've had a couple people do that. Of course, Wrestling Changed My Life hopped on as a contributor here recently. And you know, you get the shout out, you get the gear, you get all sorts of stuff. Rockfin, you get the content from all the other creators, so there's perks involved with it. So that's going to be my sales pitch here. Not gonna bore you anymore with that, but this is a good conversation. It goes pretty long, so we got two distinct segments. About first half hour of this is talking pro wrestling and its world, how it relates to our world of collegiate and international and high school wrestling, and then we go into, you know, the new books that are coming out, the series, the Wolf Stone saga that JD's got out there on Kickstarter. There is a link in the show notes at matttalkonline.com/703 to get you to that. But for now, we're talking books, we're talking wrestling, we're talking pro wrestling, we're talking with my man JD Oliva, who once had a movie called 7 Minutes and a show called The Wrestling Recap that was well before its time. We don't talk about that much this time, but that's all we got. But as always, I'd like to thank you for spending your time with me, because you've always got time for short time. Cue that swoosh.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Another episode of the Short Time Wrestling Podcast. Believe we're up to episode 703, although when you're numbering podcasts, things just kind of go wonky. The guy we got on the show, back on the show for the first time since August of 2020, JD Oliva, had a pretty good year on the coaching side of things in the state of Illinois, has another successful year on the writing side of things. We'll be talking about that. High school wrestling, Fargo, maybe some of that professional wrestling stuff that we like to wax poetic about a little bit. JD, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on. It's always fun to talk with you. I like to. We talk all the time, like regularly. It's nice to actually get on a pod and do it on a professional level.
Yeah, because it's randomly. Usually, it's most of the time it's something about Illinois or it's something about, dude, what is going on with AEW? So to give people some background, I am, you know, I grew up a professional wrestling fan. I have no ill will towards the industry or the business, as it's called. And, you know, we've got guys going into that world. We've got Gable Steveson, of course, and AJ Ferrari signed NIL deals with it. And, you know, ultimately it's a path, a revenue stream for our wrestlers. And, you know, the Creed brothers, AKA Drew and Jacob Casper, are doing pretty well in the NXT, but there's also the alternative organization. So when we were growing up, a lot of you might remember the Monday Night Wars with Raw and Nitro, WCW, WWE. Well, there's AEW out there, All Elite Wrestling. And that is where I usually, when I flip by it, that is when I'm actually texting JD to go, what's going on here with AEW? Because I don't follow it enough to pay attention to one, let alone two full time. So for those of us that may be into that professional realm, sports entertainment, if you will, if you hate the term pro wrestling because of what it is compared to our wrestling, give us the rundown on what, in short, I guess the if I haven't watched pro wrestling in 20 years version of what AEW is.
It's WCW. That's
pretty much
AEW. AEW took the template of WCW and basically brought it into the, well, I guess this part, I can't, it's, yeah, the 21st century, because they died in 2001. So AEW is basically what's worked on the independent levels and in Japan for the past 20 years, brought with an American spin. And it's totally influenced mainly more from the Crockett era stuff. Their influences are a lot of, you know, Jim Crockett,
that
Bill
was
Watts.
My era. I grew up in that part of the country, and that was my you know, Friday nights, TBS.
And that was my thing too. I was a bigger, even though I grew up in Chicago, because I was a videotape kid, I was always more connected to WCW and specifically, you know, the Jim Crockett era stuff. So I like AEW. It hits me a little bit more. It's still sports entertainment, but it's a little bit more emphasis on the sports, less on the entertainment part of it. Like, it's more about having fun matches, more so than just, you know, wild, goofy segments. And it's a lot of guys that you might recognize from WWE. Guys like CM Punk is over there. John Moxley, who used to be Dean Ambrose, Bryan Danielson, who was once known as Daniel Bryan. Those are the guys that are the big veterans there, and they got some of the most exciting young guy performers that they have going on right now. It's like if WWE is making the move to go with the guys that are the NLs, they're finding guys from colleges that, and they're trying to build their own guys up. AEW has gone the opposite route, is they're taking the best guys in the independents and in Japan and bringing them in. They have a big show coming up with New Japan Pro Wrestling. New Japan is the second, before AEW came around, the second biggest pro wrestling company in the world, based out of Japan. Way more sports-based stuff, way more hard-hitting, real fun if you can get past the language barrier. New Japan is awesome. So they're working partners here in the U.S. It's just a different flavor of pro wrestling that's a lot closer to what WCW was in its heyday. And that's for me, it hits me in the right little spots as a wrestling fan. Pro wrestling.
The CM Punk thing hits me because, you know, the best in the world, you know, I want to take CM Punk's, you know, his logo with the straight edge fist and stuff. I want to put microphones in it. I want to adopt that to what I'm doing. So get the double mics or something like that. But, you know, yes, we've started off the show with the sports entertainment realm. Now, one thing that, you know, the thing is you're in this world. So it's like, you're one of these people kind of like, me when I first got into college and high school wrestling is, yeah, we're still paying attention to that world. You actually do blogs and podcasts and stuff. Talk about like your like business side of things into that world a little bit about what you're doing over there.
When you can turn your hobby into a side gig, it's both awesome and then needlessly stressful at the same time. Like, I'm just a fan. Like, I'm here, I'm talking to you as a wrestling guy because of pro wrestling. My dad didn't wrestle. I didn't grow up in a wrestling community. I was a big pro wrestling fan and we had it in gym class. So that's how I fell into the sport. And this is what the majority of my life has been dedicated to, amateur wrestling. But as a fan, I enjoy watching pro wrestling. And then I got sucked into writing for a couple different websites. So I write for a site called Fight Game Media. I write for a site called Wrestle Joy. I just do retrospective pieces mainly for them. I talk about stuff from back in the day, and, you know, I educate mostly our audience on that site is people in their 20s or, you know, super lapsed fans or, you know, people that don't really know. And I'll say, you know, this is Magnum TA and why Magnum TA was awesome.
Or Magnum TA was a Virginia guy and wrestled at my alma mater that shall not be named.
He is the man. Love Magnum TA. Or I'll talk about, you know, here's why Antonio Inoki versus Muhammad Ali was the predecessor of MMA. And that's the kind of stuff that I do. And then I also host they have a podcast network. We have a podcast called Brace for Impact. We're with my buddy Mike Gilbert. We talk about Impact Wrestling. And it's a fun show that's sometimes fun to watch and sometimes completely maddening. And, you know, we go on back and forth, and that's kind of our wing of the Fight Game Media Network. Is, you know, we take care of there, and there they have all kinds of pods about WWE, AEW, MMA, boxing. So we got this nice little corner of combat sports, and I get to play a little bit of that. So I get to write about wrestling and do some podcasts about pro wrestling stuff and make a couple extra bucks, and it helps pay for my real job, my writing gig. So it's nice to not have to dip into the personal funds to do things. This is doing this stuff actually helps support my other business, so it's not bad.
And you also take the opportunity to talk about the college and Olympic level stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then also you bridge that gap on, hey, you know, it's almost like you put like the, okay, you know, you have to take yourself out of reality when you're watching, you know, professional wrestling. You know, most people, I think, have come to grips with that. Save the meme. It's still real to me, damn it. That thing, which is always getting a lot of mileage. But it's like, okay, you know, we're like, what's this guy going to be able to do as a performer? But you're also adding, you know, you add the, you know, the actual bona fide athletic backgrounds to it from the wrestling perspective. And we know a lot of these superstars have their sports backgrounds, whether, you know, basketball players, football players. I mean, we know that, you know, West Texas A&M back in the day supplied how many former football players to that territory. So talk about the opportunity to bring the you know, I hate to use the term real because it's such a divisive word when we're talking about sports entertainment and college and Olympic level wrestling, but you get to bring the realness of wrestling to sports entertainment with your writing.
It's so funny because like the people who get more offended, it used to be when we were growing up, I didn't talk about pro wrestling with my amateur wrestling fans because you can be fun of. And then it became cool in the late 90s. And then it was like, oh, I can be me a little bit and talk about these things.
We had the Jim Ross drinking game. I think we brought this up on last show.
Yeah,
whenever Jim Ross would drop one of his catchphrases, like,
you know, by God, or no, Triple H, no, or Hellfire, you know, we had to know how much do you drink? But it was even collar, no bow, tie up, drink. You know, we had all those in college too.
Oh, yeah,
and this is college wrestlers doing this.
If Raw was 3 hours back then, like it is now, you could die. There's just so many. It was ridiculous. But like the people I get the most pushback from is the amateur wrestling fans, because they'll sit there and talk about today's wrestling. Oh, it's just gymnastics. It's not realistic. Like in the 80s, it was real. It was way more realistic. And I got to be like, again, being the guy from the real wrestling background, like, no, that was phony too. I mean, like, you don't like the physics of you grab a guy by the wrist and throw him into the ropes. Why would he run? Like, you say this to people that are just pro wrestling fans and they get mad, right? Because they don't know anything about real combat sports. And I get way more acceptance from liking pro wrestling from my amateur wrestling people now than it the other way around. Because they think they get mad, like, well, it's just entertainment. I'm like, well, then why are you getting mad? Right? I'm trying to explain to you, like, a vertical suplex, the way they do it doesn't work. Like,
try doing that in a real fight, you know?
None of it works. You punch a dude in the head ten times, and he just sits there and takes it. Like, and again, it's theater. It's a theater thing. And amateur wrestling people watching pro wrestling get it more than some of these old school fans that fight me on it. They're like, no, it was more realistic in the 80s. And I'm like, when Kamala was telling people he was a man-eating cannibal? That wasn't reality. Like, I mean,
Kim Chi does not wear a mask in his regular life. Okay.
No,
he's named after rotten cabbage.
Right. And be like, Undertaker, he lived the business. I'm like, really? He slept in a coffin? Like, you realize what you're saying? Like, it's the most,
I love it.
The wrestling, these hardcore old school wrestling fans are the looniest. The amateur.
We get them on both sides too, because, you know, it's that term amateur. Now, this is one it's actually caused me a little bit of, you know, some arguments with some wrestling people, and having run amateur wrestling news for 18 months during a point in my career. I don't hate the term. I just think it's dated.
It is dated.
And I don't think it actually, because now, I mean, Jordan Burroughs is not an amateur wrestler. Burroughs is a professional athlete in the sport of, but that's where you have to almost quantify now. Okay, it's high school wrestling, it's collegiate wrestling, it's Olympic wrestling, or it's senior level wrestling, or international wrestling. I've kind of gone to college and international, or college and Olympic, when I explain what we do. I've had conversations with Jerry Briscoe about this stuff too, but again, I don't think all of wrestling that's not professional wrestling is amateur wrestling. I don't consider it that, because they're professional athletes.
I agree with you. And there's someone, I know a lot of friends that work indie pro wrestling, right? And they're making significantly less money in a lot of cases than guys who are just in RTCs, than dudes wrestling in the senior level. So, I mean, but you can't, calling one guy a professional and one guy an amateur is stupid, but that's like the nomenclature. And until it can be rebranded, which I'm all for, I'm not a smart enough man to tell you how to do it. But I enjoy talking to my pro wrestling fans about my friends about why something is good, about why someone can be something in amateur wrestling. Like, I've been singing the praises of, you know, Chaz Betts, Chad Gable for years, and now WWE fans are starting to see how great he really is.
It's taken a while for him.
It has.
They screwed up with his gimmick a couple times.
So many times. And he's probably a little bit more, I'd say, forgiving, but that's not really a term because it's his job, but he's been way more loyal to them than I think a lot of people would be for as many times as he's been screwed up. But now he's really starting to get it. And I'll hear people talk about like Dozer, his partner, who is a, you know, senior level high.
You refer to him as his old indie name, you know,
I don't watch a lot of WWE, so I forget what he's called now. Otis.
He was Dozer, you know, Dozer coming through in Pueblo when he was wrestling D2, getting into it out there, and, you know, Otis Dozovic, and now just Otis. I know, and it's funny because I saw them on the plane about a year ago when we were going down to Florida right before we got a dog. We did a puppycation or something like right before we got a dog, and I see, you know, and I still call, and I'm covered him in Fargo. I mean, we both seen him in Fargo. Mm-hmm. I was on the USA Wrestling staff when Chaz was in the game. So it's like, I can't call them Chad and Otis. To me, it's Nico. I see him on the plane. I'm like, hey, what's up, Nico? It's like, and I don't mark out when I see him like that. It's just because, you know, now when I see, like, you know, when I, if I would see Magnum TA, I'd be like, that's not Terry Allen. It's Magnum TA. So it's there's that crossover where it's like, no, you're always going to be Chaz to me. You know, you're not in my phone as Chad Gable. You're in my phone as Chaz Betts. So
I have that now with Tony D'Angelo. I can't do it from NXT. He's Joey Areola,
right? Yeah.
Like, I've known him since he was a freshman in high school, like when he was at Oak Park. And so I've literally known that kid since he went into Powell's room for the first time. And I'm just like, I look at him and that's Joey A. That's Joe Areola to me. And so I see it. That's it's tough to be on this side. It makes me feel really old now that guys that I've been around since they were kids are doing this stuff, and I'm struggling to do their kayfabe names. It's funny, but it's at the same time, it's cool to see these guys get opportunities, right? Because not everybody can wrestle at the senior level. And we got these high level athletes that have this talent, and this gives them another outlet. And WWE is specifically honed in on amateur level, college level wrestlers, specifically in football players, giving them another opportunity, which is great, because this is like people like amateur or pro wrestling fans get upset about this, but this is the way it was in the 70s and 80s, right? A lot of those guys got their starts either wrestling or playing football in college and didn't have any outlet to go with, right? Ken Shamrock started in professional wrestling, and then Pancrase and UFC later happened, and he was ready for the thing. Same to Tom Lawler. Tom Lawler wrestled in
Central
college.
Florida.
Yes.
He's a club guy.
Yes.
In CWA. Believe it or not, I announced him at the Carolina Open one year, and when Central Florida was, they've been hit or miss. Some years they have a really good aggressive schedule. When Tom was wrestling, he was a 235 guy, but he would have to go up to heavyweight because obviously there's no 235 right. in Division I wrestling. He's in there scrapping with D1 guys and beating them. And it's like the guy had legitimate wrestling chops.
For real.
I mean, I'd say if he'd have gone to a D1 school, he'd have qualified for the tournament. I can't say he'd been an All-American, but I think he'd have definitely been, right. If he's coming out of the Southern Conference or the ACC, I think he could have definitely. I don't know if he was, I don't think he'd have been recruited to a Big Ten school, but I think he had legitimate chops to make the show.
I agree 100%. And you could tell it because he had a successful UFC career that got derailed because of stuff that wasn't fight related. Yeah. Right now he's found a home in wrestling. He's
found an MJW, right?
He's a New Japan guy now.
MLW. Oh, okay.
He was an MLW, right. And he's actually currently the New Japan.
I say MJW. I'm mixing up wrestler names, MVP. Yeah.
It's all.
All these guys have acronyms for names now.
Yeah, the letters thing is so confusing.
Yeah.
But he's actually, New Japan has grown into the United States, and he's actually the New Japan Strong Champion, who's basically like the U.S. Well, they have a U.S. title, but that's mostly defended in Japan, which is weird. But yeah, he's pretty much the New Japan American-based champion. So he fits perfectly in with his style. His style of wrestling is more akin to what he was doing in MMA, but he's an incredible showman. He's got a big personality. And again, he's one of us. He's an amateur wrestling guy that's found a way to make a lot of money and be happy and provide for his family. And that's what I love about our guys getting into something like this, because not everybody can wrestle the senior level. Not everybody can be Jordan Burroughs, right? And this pro wrestling gives these guys who can grapple another opportunity to make a good living. And, it's fun to talk about it. It's fun to report about it. It's fun to write about it. It's fun to see guys that you knew from back in the day recreate themselves and be successful.
Well, these are conversations I've had again with I'm name dropping Jerry Briscoe here, but we talk about this and sometimes, me and Earl from Intermat will also, we both, we'll listen to the Conrad Thompson podcast. And a lot of those are from those 80s and 90s era, what happened when, and Tony Schiavone's actually a Virginia guy. And, him and Christian Piles actually went to the same high school, believe it or not.
Oh, I didn't know.
Little known fact, Buffalo Gap there, but out in the Shenandoah Valley. Now, when we look at all that stuff, it's like, yeah. And then you go back and I'm in Minnesota now where the AWA, and I noticed something like here. There's a book called, I think it's called Grappling Gold. I think I got it behind me. And it's a book about the history of Minnesota wrestling. But it's like half pro wrestling, half Olympic level wrestling. I mean, you've got, Vern Gagne's professional wrestling accolades and what he did with the AWA. So I found that up here, that vitriol between the real and the not real crowd, I'm using air quotes for those of you not watching the video, that didn't seem to exist up here because Vern gave so many former Gophers and former wrestlers from the Minnesota Wrestling Club jobs. I mean, the Iron Sheik was a coach, a Greco-Roman coach here in Minnesota, and then was starting to work in the ring crew. And then all of a sudden, Vern got him a job. And next thing you know, here's 50 years later, he is still like a social media, icon. Who doesn't love the Sheik? I mean, I got the Iron Sheik figure behind me. Next to Big John Studd and Jesse the Body Ventura, another Minnesotan. But so, I mean, it's like there's been these segments of where wrestling, you know, melds together with the sports entertainment world. And of course, guys like Jerry Briscoe, who worked as a scout forever, I'd see him at the D3s and the NAIAs every year. He's looking for talent. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're seeing that opportunity now. And I last talked to Bobby Steveson right after Gable had won the title. And I decided to ask him, hey, what's your ring name? You know, it's like, what is, you know, I was trying to figure, because it's Bobby. You know, I met him in Gable when they were in elementary, middle school, you know? So it's like,
Damon,
you know,
to see them. Kemp?
Yeah, Damon Kemp. Yeah, Damon Kemp. Yeah, so it's just, and of course, people are wondering, what are they going to do to Gable? Because there's already a Gable in there with Chad. So it's like, you kind of really can't change an Olympic champion's name, right?
No, he's too valuable right now because he's an Olympic gold medalist. It's going to be interesting to see what he does because they're going to study. He did stuff at WrestleMania. I imagine they're going to want to strike while the iron is hot with him. And he's going to have a lot of pressure to succeed immediately. Like a lot of these guys can be in NXT for anywhere from 2 to 5 years, mm-hmm. you know, figuring things out. And I don't know if he's going to get that type of opportunity. They're going to put him out there right away. And because of how quickly Kurt Angle took to this, I think the level of expectation on him is going to be a lot higher because Kurt Angle was a freak. Like he was an amazing pro wrestler. And 2 years in, like fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like you look from in 1999 when he's been doing this for like 18 months and this dude gets it. Like not only from the physical perspective, but from, you know, the performance perspective. So I think people are going to expect a lot out of Gable. And that's one of my more interesting stories of the next year or two is to see where Gable evolves into this. And it's really, really interesting because WWE, I don't want to say they de-emphasize the sports aspect of things, but everything is so corporately programmed over there. Like I'm very, very curious to see how he is built and what they do with him. It's to me, it's one of the more interesting things in the professional sports narrative right now.
Yeah. And for those, again, if you're wondering why JD and I are talking so much about pro wrestling, well, one, we both loved it growing up and JD's still very, very immersed in it. Now, you know, we talk about wrestling Twitter. When we talk about wrestling Twitter, we're talking about, you know, the college fans, the Iowa and the Penn State fans, John, and, you know, the media and our, you know, our social media personalities get into it, you know, oh, wrestling Twitter. Go into pro wrestling Twitter for a minute and you look, it is, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm during WrestleMania and I'm watching WrestleMania on the way back from the European Championships. I've got it on my iPad because, you know, I've got Peacock because, you know, we're gung ho. We just finished up season 4 of Yellowstone last night. So, you know, part of that is like, all right, I get all because I had the network. And, you know, you watch it a couple times a year. It pays for itself in the old pay-per-view fees. So mm-hmm. I'll sit there watching a 2-night WrestleMania, which was amazing. It was a great show, in my opinion. It's 5 a.m. in Budapest. And me and Sean Kenny and Vinay from India are sitting there watching it. And they're like, what is this? Like, and it was just this is nuts. And then, you know, we're seeing the highlights of Gable making his appearance. And it's like then I go to Twitter and it's like, man, they didn't pay any attention to Gable as an athlete. And then what I do think that they have some of the pro wrestling Twitter has a valid concern is Gable going to be shoved down their throats like, you know, Roman Reigns was, and there was a lot of pushback with him. Although now it doesn't seem like he's got the pushback that he did 2-3 years ago, but
no.
That's the one thing, you know, pro wrestling fans don't want to necessarily be told who to root for. You know, it's like Stone Cold's, you know, his gimmick, his heelness kind of came organically, much like the Road Warriors back in the 80s. Is like they're supposed to be the heels, but they're being cheered for. I don't know how they're going to package Gable in that regard. And I guess it's got to be something you got to be careful with is somebody with that degree of, you know, prestige. You know, what's going to happen with Gable in terms of the push is what I'm worried about.
I imagine they're going to push him quickly. And I imagine that people will turn because pro wrestling fans, especially WWE fans, but pro wrestling fans in general hate to be told what to think. Like they want to choose the star. Like this started really probably in the late 90s is when the fans really decided they needed to play a more active role in the show.
Die, Rocky, die.
That's the big one that everyone will point to. But there's other examples of Lex Luger is a one that doesn't get played up enough. But in 1993, WWE got behind Lex Luger big time with the push when he's going to wrestle with Yokozuna at SummerSlam. It didn't work. People didn't take to the guy as much as they wanted him to because he was trying to fit into being the next Hulk Hogan. He was wearing the red, white, and blue, and he just looked uncomfortable, and the fans didn't want it. So when push came to shove, they didn't go with it. So it was really awkward. And since then, fans think they can control the show sometimes. And WWE has this weird relationship with their fans. It's almost adversarial at times, right? Which is why a company like AEW could spring up because there's such a weird relationship between WWE and their fan base were there. It's so weird to be on pro wrestling Twitter and see so many people hate their hobby. And that's just, it's fascinating to me how many people just will watch Raw or watch Dynamite and will just do nothing but complain the whole time. And it's like, and I'm like, why do you watch the show if you hate it so much? It's so easy not to watch it. So, and that's the thing is if they go real hard, and the Roman Reigns is a great example, is they pushed him super hard as a babyface for like 5 years. And it really, you can't say it didn't work because business was still good, but like he would get these terrible reactions and they turned him heel. And then everybody's like, oh, this guy's amazing. Because he's in a more comfortable role now. Like they want him to be like the next John Cena, and that's just not him, right? Roman's a bit of a, you know, the character of Roman, I should say, not the guy. He's a bit of a dick. So they let him be that guy, and it's really now he's the biggest star in the business, you know, because they're just letting him be a little bit more of himself, and they don't program him as much. But they do try to program just about everybody else. So what are they going to do with Gable? I don't know. But I imagine if they start going super hard with him, that audience will reject him, and it could be like they did with Rocky Maivia, right? The audience rejected Rocky Maivia. They turned him into The Rock, and it worked out pretty good. You know,
how much do you think, I don't know if the Lesnar pattern is the same, because, you know, as physically imposing as Brock was, I think that just led to heel, yeah, bad guy. I mean, you see somebody built like that, you're just like, and with Paul, I mean, when he smiled, he looked mean. It's like, that guy's not going to be like the flag waving, you know, Hulk Hogan, yep, eat your vitamins type of guy. It's like that guy just exudes heel. So I think Gable kind of would fits that mold a little bit, just because he can, you know, it's the tattoos, it's the swagger. I think he's going to probably be a much better heel than he will be a face in that regard. Now, another person that, you know, is getting talk is, you know, we're still years away from him hitting is AJ Ferrari. And I think everybody's looking at that guy going, that guy will never be a face, just because he, I mean, it's like I compared that almost to some comic books a little bit. It's like, okay, what happens when you put on Venom, you know, if you're a Spider-Man guy, that exudes everything, it amplifies some of those traits. And I think putting AJ Ferrari into professional wrestling is just going to amplify that. You know, it's like another, it's almost like Ric Flair 3.0 with the Rolex wearing, the Versace glass. I mean, the guy already lives that gimmick. I don't want to even call it a gimmick because he dresses this way. But, you know, yeah, I've seen him actually sign tons of autographs after matches. So I know there's a dichotomy between, you know, AJ on the persona and then AJ like at a camp. You know, I've seen him sign autographs at Little Rock. And these little kids just walk away going, AJ was so nice. It was just like a sign that a lot of people don't see. So I think that him getting into it is definitely going to amplify that social media bad guy-ness that he's got already. And I think that one's money in the bank, no pun intended.
I think AJ is a better fit for this than Gable, to be quite honest with you. I think that there's this natural dichotomy to him. Like if you listen to AJ talk, you see the guy, he's hateable. Right.
I love the fact that he lives the part. He flexes on Oklahoma,
yeah,
while throwing the first pitch at the baseball game like last year. I mean, it's like, that's just, that's, you know, it. 660 pound deadlift. Woo. I mean,
yeah,
I do think he's got some Ric Flair 3.0. I'm not going to say 2.0 because it's going to be too far away from 2.0.
No, he's got a lot of that naturally. Like he does remind me a lot of Ric Flair. If he could be a good worker, like this dude, when I say worker, I mean a guy who can have good wrestling matches, because that's very important in pro wrestling. You can't just be an athlete. You have to know how to give and take and make your opponent look good. And, you know, while making yourself look good, there's an art to it. If he can figure those things out, this man could be remarkably wealthy. Like he's got an amazing personality that is real captivating, right? He's a very good athlete. He's got these intangibles, right? The way he dresses, the way he carries himself. Like it's very much, it reminds me very much of an 80s heel, but nowadays people would kind of, and they were drawn to Flair back then too. Like people loved Ric Flair. So
I hated him so much as a kid. It's genuine heat, you know, that, yeah. So let's use that pro wrestling term. Heat means you don't like that guy. You're like, you're booing guy. He, like, you know, I'll talk about my conversations with Jerry, like Honky Tonk Man was the most hated guy I just, in all the organizations, I hated him more than anything. And then Ric Flair, my stepdad liked him. And I'm like, why do you like the bad guy? And then as I get older and I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, I mean, sometimes when I have something important to tweet that I want to drop out there, I'll throw a Ric Flair tweet out there or, you know, a GIF, whatever you want to call it out there. And it's just like, and people know what I'm getting at. So, you know, you're talking about these entertainers really are. You know, they do transcend sports and pop culture and everything. So as much as it was, you know, shied down upon as we'll move off from the pro wrestling discussion here in a minute. But, you know, I don't like look at what Ric Flair is in pop culture.
Sure.
Telling me the attention, you know, and he did wrestle, but he doesn't, you know, identify himself as a former, you know, former college wrestler. You know, he wrestled high school and, you know, spent some time on the mats, you know, in football, you know, and his. You know, background's well documented, but at the same point, like we've got our own guys now that with the social media press, I mean, you know, Casper, you know, him and Drew are just doing freaking amazing things. And it's like, it's entertaining. It's bringing another group of people again to watch that. But like Kurt, and I had Kurt on the show not that long ago. And he said, yeah, he honestly knows that there are generations of kids that started wrestling just like when we thought wrestling was what it was with the ropes, like that start wrestling because they saw Kurt Angle or they want to get an MMA or they like pro wrestling. So they go to their wrestling club. And, you know, Jordan Burroughs said, yeah, I thought it was that stuff with the ropes.
Same. That's me.
I mean, our greats and you know what? What's wrong with that being an entry to the sport? So I think that with the characters that we've got going through, and I don't mean that in terms of, you know, pun with character, whatever, but I think the characters we have going in as personalities into this world of sports entertainment is going to be good for our sport because, again, some of the detractors are thinking that this is the Attitude Era. That's not been that way for 20 years. No. It's been a lot more, I don't want to say family friendly, because there's still a decent amount of boobage that, you know, but, you know, the sex appeal to it on the women's divisions and such. But it's more entertaining. It's more family friendly. And although it is a much longer show these days, I don't think I have that much time to invest in it like I did in college. But man, I tell you what, it's a better product than it was 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. And then the WWE is more family friendly. You watch AEW, it does skew older. They look for more of that 20 to 30, 40 year old fan.
They'll drop the F-bombs in the promos and such.
They'll do that.
It's edgier.
It's edgier. It gets blood. Oftentimes there's some blood on the show. The matches are a little bit more hard hitting, you know, so you have this gamut that you can run where, you know, my little guy, he'll watch some AEW with me, but I'll put him to bed when I know it's going to be ugly, because that's what I like to watch. But you know, for everyone else, there's the WWE show, and there's opportunities for guys to make a living, which is what's important. And not only make a living, but a good living, like a comfortable living, and I think that, you know, Brutus and Julius, you know, Drew and Jacob, they're like the Steiner brothers reincarnated. They're doing great work down there in NXT. They're going to be huge stars, and I see this as nothing but a positive. Right. And it'll be a matter of time before AEW starts doing the same thing and looking for guys from the college level to come in and become, you know, future pro wrestlers. And I think it's awesome. I like it a lot.
Yeah. One thing that I really like about the Creed brothers is Drew's impact. So, you know, it's Jacob's other brother who wrestled at Division III at Otterbein and, you know, a solid Division III wrestler, you know, had a real good career. It's just really, he was undefeated going to Nationals 1 year. And it's like, oh, okay, there's Drew. And it's just cool to see that, you know, people were singing the praises of how Jacob was going to be this next thing in the WWE. And the fact that you know, Drew's right there with him is kind of cool to watch from that situation.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we're going to have to shift gears here. So we've got half an hour on pro wrestling. Now what we actually brought JD on to talk about. Sorry, you had a great season coaching, but we're not going to. It's less about wrestling than it is about what you're doing now. You've got your... We got 9 total novels. We got a new one. I'm going to bring it up here on the screen for those of you watching the Kickstarter. So just walk us through what we've got on screen here and what we got. Your 9th novel, 3 of them dropping out here via Kickstarter.
Yep, 9, 10, and 11. I've been doing this professionally for about 4 years now, and I'm a fiction writer. Like, this is my other life, the other side of my brain. I went to school to be a filmmaker, and I did it, and I found that I hated filmmaking. There's nothing worse than being on a film set for 12, 14 hours a day. But I still had all these ideas in my head, and, you know, I've gone into writing. Like, I've done a bunch of comics, and now my focus is doing prose fiction. So this right here is my newest series. It's urban fantasy. That's basically a fancy way of saying like comics. Like, if you like the Marvel movies and stuff like that, these books are in that wheelhouse. It's about a young girl whose mom passes away from cancer, and her dad died before she was born, and she finds a family heirloom. And when she picks it up, she blows a hole in the side of the wall. And she decides she needs to find out a little bit more about this little talisman, and discovers that her father may have been a superhero, but there are no superheroes in the real world. So how is that possible? And this is like, these three books are her journey into discovering her family history. And it really taps into the literal history, because we learn about her grandfather, who was a private eye in San Francisco in the 30s, and his misadventures there, and her grandfather, who kind of was like this lone ranger type of character in the Old West. And these stories kind of intertwine upon each other, and it's this girl trying to figure out her role in this grand scheme of the universe and avoid the apocalypse. So yeah, these three books launched on Kickstarter last week. We've got another 10 days to go on the project. We hit our funding goal last week, but now we're trying to go above and beyond. We had our first stretch goal, which is the audiobook version. So we have to hit, we're about 500 bucks away from hitting the $2,000 mark to fund the audiobook, which is going to be interesting, because it's told from it's the girl and her grandfather are the two voices of the story. So we're looking to get I got the people in mind. We got a female narrator and a male narrator who are going to bounce the chapters back and forth. That's going to be a unique experience to audiobooks. I'm a big audiobook fan. So that's the story of this book. And we're also,
I know a guy that does some voice work, right?
I do know a guy who does some voice work, but I know he's also pretty busy. So yeah, these are fun. And my other books, if you like the other stuff, this is, like I said, like more urban fantasy type stuff, action adventure. The rest of my work is more like horror thriller based. And you can buy those books in this campaign too. Like, you have an opportunity to buy everything I've ever written. There's several free books that are available with it. We had a giveaway last week where, if you backed the campaign last week, I got 40 other authors to donate their books. So you could have gotten in on that. That would have been cool, but we closed that off. And this week, I'm giving away 4 of my other Ethan Jericho horror stories just for backing the campaign. You get those books for free. We're doing a lot of cool things. Like, I like Kickstarter because, to be quite frank, the publishing world, if you're not Stephen King, they don't really care about you, the big publishers. So Kickstarter gives chance guys like me, the indie guys, a chance to really stand out. And you do these campaigns and, quite frankly, make a lot of money before they go into Amazon. And I have a chance to make more money here than I do selling them on Amazon, because Kickstarter takes a much smaller percentage of what we get. So we got that going for another week and a half, 10 more days. And these are, that right there is the prequel novel that tells the story of the mother when the child was just little. And that's for free. That's a $1. You get that book for $1 just by jumping onto the campaign.
So wait, you get the 3-book series, then a prequel that you've already written to it as well?
Yep, the prequel. And here's some of my old stuff. Harvest Moon is my werewolf story that introduced Ethan Jericho character. That's available here. There's the Books of Jericho series, with 6 books in that series as of right now. You know, those are all horror thriller stuff about an international assassin whose work just gets him involved in dealing with monsters and demons and whatnot. So you can buy that there with the series. Every single book is available. And that's my first book, Hawk Hollow, a haunted house story on Halloween. Like I said, my entire catalog is available in this Kickstarter. And right now, it's the only place you can get it. I took my books off of Amazon for the rest of the month because I want people to check out this campaign, because I believe in these 3 books specifically. And, you know, I think that you should get involved and check them out. They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'll put a link up to the Kickstarter in the show notes. So, you know, we've got that right there again, the Stone Wolf Saga. So as we will take this off the screen and talk a little bit about the development, not necessarily of characters, because I've always thought about writing books, and most people think that the logical thing for me to do covering wrestling is I've got to write some, I got to write some nonfiction. I got to write some, here's some stories, right? Do some biographies and things of that nature. You know, there's people in wrestling that are doing really well with that. But I've also been focusing on, with the Hall of Fame, with our podcast series, a lot of the documentary stuff there. But what I'm wondering is that the time, because like you said, yeah, I am pretty busy. I'd love to do some of this voice work and stuff. But at the same point, I'd love to be able to sit down and write a book. But I feel like I'm struggling just to be able to get enough podcasts out and be able to do the research with all this. How do you find time to be a high school wrestling coach to write and then do all your other, you know, the 30 minutes of the beginning of the show, we talked about the work you're doing with the professional wrestling. How do you budget your time for something like this? And, you know, I guess what's the, when it comes time to put pen to paper to write a novel, what's the process?
For me, I don't really write until I have the idea solid in my head. I'm a big outline guy. I'm very much, because I come from comics and I come from film, like Stephen King, I use him, he's my favorite writer. He's a guy who can just sit down and just write, and he doesn't know where the story is going until it ends. I can't be that guy. That's just not how I came up. So I'm very strict into, I write my outline, I have my flow chart. I'm a big believer in the three-act process, so I make sure I map all that stuff out. I know who my characters are. And then when I'm writing the book, stuff will change, stuff will evolve. You know, characters will find their voices and things will move. It's like you're driving, like you're going on a drive. Like, I'm going to go from New York to California. I know how to get there. When I'm driving, maybe I take an exit here and there and take the long way, or, you know, perhaps I don't stop at this place I planned on stopping. You know, stuff evolves. When it's time to write the book, I sit down and I block out 30 or 40 minute chunks, because in 40 minutes I can write 1,000 words. I train myself to be able to do that. So if I put 40 minutes on the clock, I turn off Twitter, turn off the computer, I turn off the internet, I put on Spotify, I put the headphones on, and I just go. And I get 1,000 words, whether I hit it in 32 minutes, whether I hit it in 43 minutes. I get 1,000 words. And then my goal is to get about 3,000 words a day. And when I do about 3,000 words a day, about 6 days a week, 5 to 6 usually, I find that I can get the majority of a first draft done in about a month, maybe a little bit over a month. And then it's just editing from there. So, I mean, I don't do much else. Like, people say, oh, did you watch this thing on TV? No, I didn't. You know, I'm a dad too. That's also my most important job. So I go,
yeah, that whole family thing. Yeah. We neglected to mention that, but you know, that goes without saying. You know, because yeah. I've, you know, but right that, now as we record this, like, my daughter's upstairs home sick from school today. So no, it's not COVID. She's fine, but it's just, you know, it's one of the things. Okay, I've got to sit there, and you know, my wife and I work from home, and and it's like, okay, well, you're a much bigger business person than I am, so you know, her work tends to come first in that regard. So okay, you got to work these things in. And you know, I you know, looking to do my own research and stuff. You know, I'm looking at, you know, chronicling all of the old amateur wrestling teams. Like, I want to know how many college teams we had in a given year. And the only way to do that's go through the pages of Amateur Wrestling News and the NCAA guide. So I'm curious on that time management blocking stuff. But also when it comes to books, for those who are unfamiliar, a novel and a not, you know, going nonfiction, going novels, going fantasy, horror, what's the honeypot, I guess, for word length, you know, number of words in a novel? How many pages are we looking at? That seems to be where you can tell a good story in those three acts.
It's funny, because I think it changes. Like, I'll challenge myself a little bit, because when I first started, I came from comics, and my dialogue was, my writing was sparse, because that's what's encouraged in comics, is you get, say what you need to say and move on. And then in writing and, you know, prose, you're encouraged to be a little bit more verbose. Don't go crazy, but, you know, explain, you know, tell, you know, paint a picture with words. I tend, like, typically a novella is anything under 30,000 words. A short story is anything under 10,000 words. So, and I deal with words. Like, people say, how many pages? I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea. Cause when you print it out, it's always going to be different. Like the same.
Yeah, this isn't college. Okay. What, 12 point double space?
Yeah, exactly.
What font can we get the two pages on? Garamond, you know, you know, like, you find the right spot to get the biggest amount to get the less. Yeah.
Well, look at it this, like, Immortal, the first book in this series, mm-hmm. is about 80,000 words. That's about 400 pages. Black Dog, the third book in the series, is 100,000 words. That's about 500 pages, roughly. So I tend to find that anywhere between, you know, 55 and 100,000 words is the stories that are mine tend to be. I've got the short story on there, Talisman. That's about 26,000 words. You know, and that felt about right for the story. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew where to go, you know, stayed focused. The goal was to get the chapters in and here again, because I plot, I'm a plotter. I don't let things go too far. I know pretty much the ballpark of where I'm going to go. The Black Dog, the last book, it went a little bit more wild than I expected it to go. That's why I wound up within the 100,000 word range as opposed to 80,000 word range. But that's what the story took me. Like, I knew where it was going to go, and it took a little bit longer to write it, but it's a better book because of that. So as far as length goes, anywhere between 50 and 100,000 is like a good, 100,000 is a pretty big novel. You talk about these Stephen King, you know, massive things. Those are about 150. Game of Thrones is about 200,000 words, you know, maybe even more. Like it gets a little stick. But I mean, the vast majority of novels released on Amazon are about 50 to 70,000 words these days for a novel. And that's where you can charge like typical novel rates for price.
Gotcha. So, and one thing is, you know, when I, you know, having spent my, you know, last 20 some years in the journalism world, whether, you know, I don't do a lot of heavy feature writing anymore, but, you know, I remember when, you know, I'll use this as a good example, as when you have a good story to write and you're worried about what do you leave out? So I'll use the Mike Pasillo story, for example. The news when he came out was kind of big, and I'm talking to coaches, I'm talking, getting perspective. And my first draft of this thing was 10,000 words for an article. Now that's just an article, and that's way too long. So I'm sitting there, I'm looking at this, and I actually work with Andy Hamilton on it. Cause you know, at the time he's working at the paper, and he's, you know, he knows, you know, what's a good feature, what's a good enterprise piece that people aren't going to sit there and scroll and be TLDR. 2,000 words was probably the right length for that story. And we got a really good crisp story out of that. But again, if I, you know, as verbose as I can be, there's two parts to this question. When it comes time to that first draft, when do you start pruning the extra stuff that, you know what, this doesn't make sense to the story. This chapter runs a little long, and not necessarily length, but it just kind of drones on. It's like watching a series, for example. Well, this episode was kind of slow. They could have just chopped that, and let's go with this. So how do you determine that? What is the editing process like for you in something like this?
I tend to, because I write such tight outlines, and because like I stick so tight to my formulas, and again, my chapters are almost always 1,000 words. So when I sit down to write, I write a chapter, right? And I know if I get to about 15, I can get to about 1500 words and then I'm out. Like, I know that's too much. I know that's my max. Like for me, I just tend to keep it around there. Like I try to keep everything to a scene. Like all my chapters are one scene. Like, and again, I think it's because I have a background in comics and a background in film where a scene is 2 pages, both cases. So my brain has related that to about 1,000 words. Okay. Right. And if I need a little bit more, I go a little bit more. And my brain is just trained at this point where my articles, like on WrestleJoy, they're about 1,000 words. And sometimes they get a little long, you know, and I'll pull back a little bit, but I tend to have a problem having to beef things up more than pull back. Like I tend to have to go, okay, I got to go deeper into this. You know, that's more my issue than the other way. I'm not as, again, because I come from film, I come from comics, where you're instructed to be as brevity is the key to everything. You know, be as tight as possible. You know, if you can say something in 10 words, say it in 6.
That's kind of my problem in a conversation. My wife jokes about that to me all the time. She says, I can say something in 8. You have to say it in 80. So, again, I feel like the verboseness of writing, you seem to have that down to a key, you know, down to a science with the, you know, your outlines. So, for example, I've tried to outline a couple things. I use Scrivener to start and yeah, okay, let's try this. Yeah. You know, and, but at the same point, I was like, okay. And I've got a to-do list of 800, you know, I think I'm up to 500 people to interview that it just keeps adding. So again, it's being able to prune it, trim it and be like, okay, that's where I think I would struggle, but it definitely seems like the outline is the way to go. Now, another thing is when you have a series, when do you decide to end one book and start on another? Where do you find that natural ending for a novel?
I tend to focus on every series is a chapter, like, right? Every book is its own chapter in a longer series, right? So I have an idea, like I'm very character, like when I write, it's very character driven, but my brain is very plot oriented. So like, I'll give you an example, like this story, this Immortal I wrote first time, the first draft of this was years and years ago. So I knew the beginning, I knew the end. Right. And it wasn't until I got into the business part of writing and they're like, hey, you know what? You should write in series. And I'm like, oh, what do I do? And then I thought about, this is the next book of the series. It's like, this is the story. And then, okay, well, the next book, then I can do this. You know, I don't plot. I know guys that plot like 10 books in a series in advance. I can't do that. For me, it's like, it's more episodic. Like these, it flows together, but they're more like episodes. And these books in particular are take place in different years. Like, so book one takes place in 2019, book two takes place in 2020, book three takes place in 2021. So it was easier for me to kind of fragment that. And because these books are really, they're really about my love of comics. Like, so part of it is like, okay, the first chapter is like stuff I loved about the early days of 1930s comics. Book two is more about, okay, I like World War II. right? Then book three is the 1950s, right? Stuff like that. So I was able to, and again, it all takes place today, but like the elements of the story refer to that. So for me, it's like, okay, this is very segmented, like the Jericho books. My first idea was, okay, him versus the underground lizard people. Boom, that's the story. The next book is he finds the devil's prayer, like this real life secret thing that was part of this Bible, like, you know, is missing pages, and it's supposed to be a prayer to the devil. He's looking for that. He finds that, story ends. Boom. You know, that's kind of where it goes. And then they just, it's the character elements that lead to the next story overall. Like when you're writing a TV show, you have an overarching plot, and you have like that week's monster of the week story in like the case of like a supernatural or something like that. So you hit your points, and then it's your subplots that carry you throughout the series. So you take down the major plot, or you take down the major villain or whatever, and then it's the trails that left behind that helps feed into the next story. Like the best thing I've come up with is I wrote a book called Nightcrawler. It's the third book of the Jericho series. He defeats the villain, but he has done, it's been too bad. Like he was controlled by this mind control worm. It's an awesome story. And
spoiler alert.
we kill the villain, but he has to fake his own death, right? To get out of what he's done. So he fakes his own death and he gets away with it. And then we start the next book. The FBI has found him. And that jump starts the next series where he's arrested and his plane crash lands in the Canadian wilderness and they have to deal with the Wendigo. So that's how you do that kind of thing, is you take the elements that you're left behind and you bring that into the next book and you use that to start it. And then that comes from just having the basic tent poles. Like I knew I wanted to do a story about an evil worm. I knew I wanted to do a story about the Wendigo. How can I connect them? And then while you're writing the book, is you have all these characters that you're balancing out and you see, oh, you know what? I can use this character here to bridge this into there because they had this interaction. Right. And that's just, again, when you're insane, these things make sense in your brain, as you can balance these things out. So again, it doesn't, I say this and I think I sound like a madman, but it makes
I'm
sense.
Like, oh, what is a Wendigo?
Well, Wendigo is a Native American spirit creature that existed in like the Northern Canadian the Northern Canadian woods, that it basically is just a monster. Like, you know, it kills people.
A Canadian chupacabra.
Sort of. It's like a combination of it's like, imagine if Bigfoot was more mystical, right?
Well, more the problem is Bigfoot is blurry.
He is blurry, but not mystical. There's a difference. There's no magic with Bigfoot. There's magic in the Wendigo.
I thought Smallfoot taught us that it was mystical creature. Anyway, you know, we're getting into kids' movies now. Next thing is like, so again, to draw things on my experiences here, I have a giant shelf of books. I'm not a big reader, and that's kind of the problem. I feel bad every time somebody sends me a book and it takes me a while to get to it. I'm looking at my daughter right now, who is 9, and she is diving into Harry Potter. Awesome. And, you know, we're going, okay, book one is this year. Book two is this year. She's working on book four. Now, granted, at 9, she's not diving into them, but she's gotten through them. Like, okay. And she's picking up things. I expect her to go back and reread them when she's 12 to pick up more things.
Right.
But in looking at that year by year serialized type of, you know, series of stories, do you have any other series that you've read that have kind of served as an inspiration or is like not necessarily a blueprint, but like, I liked how this is laid out. This is how I want to write this series.
My inspirations for these kind of things come like Brad Meltzer has a series of books, The Book of Lies. It started the Book of Fate is where it starts off, and it springs into these books about like this archivist in DC, and it taps into all these conspiracy, like DC conspiracy theories. And like, again, it was like, I believe the first one was the plot to kill Washington and how that related to what the bad guys are trying to do. And my inspirations for a series more come from comics than from like a novel series. Cause I'm a bigger fan of standalone novels. Like I'm a big Stephen King fan. Stephen King's my favorite writer. So if I'm looking at a series like The Dark Tower is his big series, and I wouldn't advise anybody try to take elements from The Dark Tower because it's just too sprawling. It's just too epic. Right. So for me, stuff like Scalped from Jason Aaron is the way you would do a series. It's like, that was a comic book series from DC Vertigo that existed in the mid aughts about an undercover FBI agent on a Native American casino and what happened there. So it's awesome. It's one of the best books ever written, in my opinion. So like, you just take little elements of that and you address story A, right? And then stories B and C kind of filter down. Like, There's this comic writer named Paul Levitz who had this theory that when you're writing a series, you have your A plot, your B plot, and your C plot. You resolve your A story first, and then your B story becomes the A story, your C story becomes the B story, and then you introduce a new story for your C story. And that was how he kind of moved things on, is you address one thing, and then the thing that was brewing underneath becomes the more important thing. And that's how he continued his series throughout. And I've taken a lot of that, not like 100%, like I'm religious to it, but I like the idea of it where I'll try to introduce stuff here that I know is going to be important later. Right. So you're introducing your audience to a concept or a character or something, and it's not super important now, but you have to lay the groundwork for it. Right. So that when you do embrace it, it's there. Like in the end of Black Dog, the series, the third book in this series, the story ends, but the characters are in a very bad place. And throughout that story, I set up the villains for the next book, which might be the conclusion of the series. I haven't figured it out yet. I want to write the book first, but I knew I had to get there. I knew where I was going, but I had to get there. So I'm like, you know what? Here's an opportunity. I saw it. I said, here's an opportunity where I can start introducing people to the next villain and how they come into the world. And then when I did that, I said, oh my God, there's so much I can play with just by doing that. Because part of writing is you reading the book as you're creating the book. Like you're learning the story as you're going through it. And because you're kind of in charge of it, but the story really tells itself, things can grow and change through you, which is really fun. And a lot of times when you have these ideas for a series, you really just have like, I know where I want to go, but I'm not 100% sure how to get there. When you're writing the book, you're figuring out how to get there. And like I said, the editing process, why you got to have a good editor work with you. It helps you flush it out. It helps you figure out what's working and what isn't working. I've been lucky where they say, hey man, we can go a little deeper here. I don't think you've answered enough of these questions. That's the edits that I get. Lot of us, I think I need to understand more of why this works here. So I'm like, okay. So I'm not giving you enough because my brain is okay. Take back, not just splurge. So I have to be encouraged to like push more in, right? Because I think I hold back too much sometimes.
Well, one thing that I'm wondering is where you have to hold back is when you come up with the idea, especially when you're in the fantasy, the horror stuff, when you get into the supernatural and stuff. When you know, because part of these things is I think about it from a musician standpoint. Sure. You got a good riff in your mind. Chances are you've probably heard that somewhere before. So yeah, an idea for maybe the origin of a character or origin of a monster or a demon or something like that. How do you come up with their backstory to make it? You know, I basically come up with something that's original or is obviously there's inspirational. Okay, well, like I used the example of a chupacabra, for example, because that sounds like something I've heard of before. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe how do you develop, that enemy, that using that fantasy aspect to tell a story that's just pretty much conjured up out of thin air. Or how do you create a new legend kind of thing?
The best thing that I've had success with is taking something that people know and then putting your own spin on it. Cause that's what people really want. I wrote a Kickstarter campaign for a Jericho book last year called Sundown. It was a vampire story. I wanted to write my own vampire story. So I thought about what I like about a vampire and what I don't like about it, what I think is played out, what I think is silly. And what would I like to emphasize? What would I like to de-emphasize? So I sat back and I created my own version of what that is. And then you have to put that into a character. So before I even write a book, as I'll sit there, the first thing I do is I'll get the concept in my head and I'll let it cook a little bit. Cause sometimes you get concepts that don't work. So you got to let it, once I sell myself, hey, this is a good idea. Okay. What is he? Cause character is far more important than plot. People get so into the idea of a book. It's like, well, what's it about? And it's like, yeah, okay. And then they tell you about the world they've created. Well, there's this world and blah, 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 blah. And they give you all the details about the world. But stories don't work unless we believe in the characters. Like that's what connects people to movies, television, books, whatever, is to have a character that they like. So when I have an idea, I sit there. The first question is, okay, who is he? What is he? Why? Like what? So that's what I'll do. I'll sit there and I'll just write out like John Grey Wolf. He's one of the protagonists of this series. Okay, who is he? Okay, he's okay. Private eye from San Francisco in the 1930s. What did he do? Okay, so let's figure he was 40 years old. So he probably fought in World War I. And then I'll word vomit basically onto the page of what I think this guy is about. Some of it makes it into the book. Some of it becomes super intricate to the book. Some of it doesn't. But I think that, and I learned this actually from an act when I was making this piece of crap movie in the mid 2000s, I learned from an acting friend, like when an actor gets a character, they have to build the backstory in their head. It doesn't matter.
Are you talking about your wrestling movie that we've touched on before?
That would be that movie. But I learned the most valuable thing I got from that experience was when I was working with this acting coach. And she said, like, I always have actors build their character. So it's more than what's on the page. So I took that and I brought that into writing, because if I'm going to write a character, I want to know everything about them, right? And then if I'm writing, and there's been times I've done this where I've written about a character and I'm like, this person isn't interesting to me at all. And I just throw them away because like I've created a character that doesn't work and it never makes its way to a book. And that's fine. That's better. It's better that I've done that. But I'm a firm believer in like, I get a concept, right? And then I have to build the person around the concept. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Like Ethan Jericho was just the main driver of my Jericho books. He was just a character in my werewolf book, but I fell in love with writing him because I was writing the character. I'm like, what is he? Okay, he's this assassin, and he he has this murky background. Maybe he was military, maybe he wasn't, you know. And I'm like, okay, there's a lot I can do with. I fell in love with the character. I'm like, okay, there's a lot I can do with this guy. So it spawned its own series of books based on the fact that I was super interested in writing him based on me just sitting there and trying to figure out what he was about. And I made him as murky as possible. And that is what intrigued me to him. Like that's my process, is I gotta figure out the dude behind the concept before I can write the story about them.
How much do you have to be aware of what's going on around in the world we're in? So for example, you brought up vampires. So let's see, let me think. When did I live in Minnesota the first time, 2008, 2009, True Blood drops. So we got vampires. So now how much do you have to be aware of what's going on, pop culture, other novels, other series and such, to make sure that like it doesn't seem too similar? I mean, do you almost have to go super avoidance? Okay, I like this spin on a vampire. Ah, crap, that was just on True Blood. Or do you have to just ignore that and just hope you don't get the comparisons to it?
Comparisons are going to happen no matter what you do, right? There's only, I think there's 7 stories a writer can tell. There's only 7. Everything's a variation on those 7. It's all about execution, right? Everything comes down to how something is executed. Salem's Lot and Dracula are the same book. It's the same book. It's the same exact story, but it all comes down to how it's executed, right? King is a different writer than Bram Stoker. So you get a vampire story about a vampire coming to a different place. He has to have his home world moved with him, and it's how he interacts with the people around. It's the exact same book, but it's all how they execute it. So for me, and you know, vampires aren't real, so they can be whatever you want them to be, right? And especially that's why I like dealing with fantasy, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, it doesn't matter if I want my vampire. What if he wants to come out in the daytime? Well, in this world, vampires can come out in the daytime. You know, it's fiction. And as long as the characters are playing by the rules that you've created, you're fine. As long as you're not changing stuff midway, because that's when people go, oh, well, what is it? And again, with fiction, your job is to create and to be, is to be a little bit, true to your own story, true to your own self. As far as like your influences and stuff like that, it's like a salad bar, man. Take what you want and leave the rest. And understand that you're going to get compared. That's okay. Like I said, I wrote a vampire story too. That's also could be related to Dracula, but I also included it with like Instagram models, right? Because that's something that's going on now, and influencers and that kind of stuff. And it was a pyramid scheme, basically. My vampires are building a pyramid scheme. And it's again relating to the end of the world. Because again, that's me.
Gee, what's a vampire? Pyramid schemes and bloodsuckers. That seems extremely relevant and believable.
And again, sometimes those things that you see bleed in, because I didn't plan on doing that. Like, it wasn't like I'm going to make this great social commentary on direct marketing. That wasn't my plan. I wanted to write a vampire story, and I was building the guy, and I was workshopping the story with my brother and a friend of mine. And we started throwing these different, like, how do we make it different? Because that's the, how do you make it different? Because a million stories have been told. So I was thinking about how we can make it different. And a buddy of mine said, well, what about doing, involving Instagram models? And that got me interested of like the whole world of influencers and how these companies will pay these influencers a lot of money to make these posts. And it got me thinking about direct marketing, which is kind of something similar to that. And I'm like, oh, vampires. It's all there.
Great. So, yeah. Count Dracula, sign up for my Advocare.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that it was an influence in my story. You inferred that.
No, I'm
not my words.
I'm just throwing one out there that wrestling people know. Well, just because
we've all heard the sales pitch. So
you might, all right, let's just say, hey, you want me to sell it? No, you look at me. I'm not selling health products. I'm selling cookware. Okay, nobody's gonna believe me if I'm selling health products. Anyway, side note. But but moving forward, now one thing I did. I meant to come back to earlier, and let's circle back to is when you're writing this many words, there's only so many words the human brain really knows and uses frequently enough, or, you know, or infrequently enough. It's like, how often are you going to a thesaurus or something like that to bring words in, or you just stick with common language? Because that's one thing I worry about in writing, is like, are my words, you know, different enough to where it's not just, I'm not just repeating the same thing. You know, as a kid, we learn, you know, adjectives. Okay, that one's nice. That one's nice. That one's good. Nice. Good. Nice. And then you get over the top. Oh, that's, you know, that's incendiary. Or, you know, like I use that, you know, like the scene from Almost Famous. You know, it's like, okay, how do you develop basically the vocabulary you're using within a novel? And how do you make sure it's diverse enough to be, you know, doesn't drone on in that regard?
Mark Dawson is the biggest name in independent publishing. He's been an Amazon bestseller, number one in all of Amazon. He's got a small empire that he's created. And he's of the mind that it takes about 1 million words to find your voice. You have to have written 1 million words before you really have your voice. And I have hit that. I'm right around that point right now in my own writing world. So the answer is, I don't know. You got to figure it out. And like, how does it, how, the way to me is like, how do you talk? Right? Like, what, how would you actually say something? Too many writers fall in love with words, and I love words too. But at some point you got to bust out the thesaurus. Cause like, there's only, I mean, I can't write the word Jericho or, you know, 100 times, or I can't write Jen like in these books. Like, I got to find another way to describe them, or I got to find, like, I wrote about it. Like, this story is about a magic talisman. So I had to find 3 or 4 different ways to describe the stupid thing around her neck, because I didn't want to say the same thing over and over, because that is boring and it is repetitive. But at the same time, you can't just sit there and throw gigantic words at people, because it'll take them out of the book. Like, there's a time that people would do that. They would just do big words, and then people are looking things up, and like, people used to be considered cool. But I think now, you know, especially me, I'm basically a popcorn writer, right? And I want to be a popcorn writer. So I want my books to be as accessible as possible.
Well, so what do you mean popcorn writer? What's that term mean?
Like if you go see a movie, right? You go see a movie, okay, theater, you want like an action movie or something like that. Like, I'm not like, Stephen King I would consider a popcorn writer, right? Or Brad Meltzer, some guys like that, like popular fiction writers. Gotcha. Like, I'm not Kurt Vonnegut. You know, nor am I trying to be. So that's kind of where I'm at, is I don't want to bombard people with big words. And I can use big words when I need to. And sometimes you need to. Sometimes you create a character that talks like that. And that's okay, because that's their voice. But when you're the narrator, you want it to be as accessible as possible without sounding dumb. You know, it's figuring it out. That's the hardest part about writing a book. And that's the hardest thing for me too, was I've written books for years, and it took me a long time and a lot of edits and a lot of figuring out my own voice to get them publishable. Right. And that's when working with an editor helps, and, you know, trying things and maybe throwing some big words out and having some say, yeah, you really need this word, you know, stuff like that. But you don't know until you do. Right. And not, this is the thing, this is the one lesson I tell, like, you know, how do you write a book? I'm like, well, just don't be afraid to fail. You know, that's one thing I can say, is I've never been afraid to fail at something, right? I've done plenty of it. So, and that's okay, is you're going to get better. And that's the wrestler mentality in me, is, right? Like, you need to work at something and train at something before you get better. You know, and like, my little guy's wrestling this year for the first time, and, you know, he took third in his first tournament, and he was happy. I'm like, yeah, you did good, man. Lost your first match, won your second. Awesome day. Next time he went around, he just got shellacked, like just absolutely shellacked. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, we're learning. You put yourself out there, you fail. And that's part of learning. And I'm guilty of that, is I put myself out there and I failed, but that's how you get better. And it's that fear factor of not being afraid to fail, sometimes on a massive scale. That's okay. Like I said, I made a movie in 2005, 2006 that was not very good, but I learned so much. I learned how to make a movie. I learned how to deal with people. I learned how to write a script. I learned how to tell a story. And that's far more valuable than anything I could have gotten from that. So that's the thing, is like, you just figure it out. Cause like, everyone who's written a book, you can take all the classes in the world. You can listen to all the podcasts. You can, you know, read the books that tell you how to do it. But until you sit there and you're doing it and you're having people read it and say, I like this, I don't like this, fix this, that's good. Like, you're never going to get there. You're never going to get better. And I'm not a perfect writer by any stretch of the imagination. I want to get better every time I do this. So the only way to get better is just like wrestling. You go out there and you do it. And you work on it later, you know?
Wrapping up in terms of reading. Okay, this is one thing I need help with. And this is one thing, with, if you've got people, you know, that are, okay, they're interested in JD and wrestling. Okay, And they may not be avid readers, or they may have a hard time approaching something, because I'm not a horror fantasy guy. I'm more of a, you know, I'm trying to think. I think the exception is I read all the Hunger Games books.
Oh, me too.
So,
those are great.
You know, I've got that. So, you know, I read all those in a weekend. And then when the prequel came out, I blitzed through that in a weekend. And I'm like, that's the biggest book I've ever read, like, in a weekend. And my wife goes through, you know, 3-4 books a month, most of them on her phone with, you know, with the Kindle app and whatnot. But like, how would I approach this series when somebody who's, I'm not really a big reader. Now, when I read, I can go in spurts, but it's like, how do you keep somebody hooked in, and how do you kind of tell people to learn how to be a reader, especially if the content is something that they're typically not, that's not their hobby, for example. I mean, I got a ton of books about wrestling on the shelf here, and a ton of books about the ABA and old, you know, true, you know, stranger than fiction type of sporting events and stuff like that. And, you know, best in American sports writing stuff. But how do I approach this? How does people like me approach this?
Most of the people in my friend circle and that I know are far more like you than they're, quite frankly, nerd like me. I've always been this kind of a nerd. Like, I love comics. I love horror movies. Like, I'm wired weird. So when that's hard. Like I said, I have to as a creator, not take it personally when my friends or my circle isn't interested in what I'm doing. That's okay. Right. But if someone wants to try something, I think that I have a prequel book. That's what Talisman is. That is a nice little sample into what I do in the world and all that. And if you like this little sample, you're going to like what I do. And if you don't like it, if it's not for you, that's totally cool too. There's different kinds of books. That's why there's different kinds of books and different kinds of genres for everybody. And every writer, like Stephen King, most famous writer in the world, right? He maybe 1/100th of the country reads his stuff. You know, that's okay. Like, if you look about it, it's a massive failure. But when you really focus in on it, like, what I'm trying to do is find people that like my stuff. And that's why you cast this wide net. You find people that dig what you do, and you provide them the things they want. And if someone wants to try something, which I'm all for too, right? Like, I'm a big King fan. The first thing I ever read from him was an 85 page short story. You know, Blockade Billy. It was a book about a serial killer baseball player. It was awesome. I loved it. And that's what got me into Stephen King. You know, I knew him. I saw the movies, but I never read any of his books until I was like, I don't know, 28, 29, something like that. And then now I'm a junkie. I've read all the Dark Tower books. I do all this stuff. Like, he's been my major influence as a writer. But that's for me. That's how I do it. So I said, for me personally, I got this 26,000 word novella. I think it's maybe 100 pages. It's available for $1 on the Kickstarter. Try it out. If you miss this Kickstarter, that's fine. They're going to be available on Amazon forever, right? This is just my launch. This is just my way of saying, hey, I'm doing this cool thing. Come jump on board. And if you want to jump in, awesome. If you don't, very cool too. But if you just want a sample, $1, you get a book. You know, it's going to take you about a night or two to read it, and you get a nice little sample of what I'm about, or what this particular series is about. And if you like it, there's more to where that came from. And if you don't, hey, thanks for trying. I've read books, dude. I'm almost embarrassed to say this. I read Something Wicked This Way Comes from Ray Bradbury earlier this year. I didn't like it. And I'm embarrassed to say that because, like, you know, Ray Bradbury is one of the classic American authors. It just didn't hit with me. I was fully expecting to love it. And I just wasn't feeling it. And that's perfectly fine. Believe me, the Ray Bradbury estate doesn't need my money or my, you know, my endorsement. Every writer hits a reader differently, and sometimes doesn't hit them at all. That's okay too. You know, we're just trying to provide another outlet for people to be entertained for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I like Chuck Palahniuk, so I've got a couple of his books, and some of those I think Pygmy was one where I got about 30 pages into it. I'm like, I cannot finish this.
Yeah.
I just, cause the way it was written was so, machine-like in some respect, or so I don't even know how to describe it. I was just like, I'm trying. Whereas I think it was, was it Invisible Monsters? I'm not sure. That one I freaking thought was fantastic. And then his Stranger Than Fiction, you know, his short story, you know, his collection of short stories, which does feature wrestling. That was actually it wasn't Fight Club that was my introduction to his stuff, but it was his Stranger Than Fiction stuff, which was like, you know, I remember my father-in-law picked up that book one time, and chapter one is about swingers in Montana. let's just say that my my fairly religious in-laws, as soon as I sit there and see him read, I'm like, no, not that one. I grabbed it. I said, you can read this chapter where it features, you know, Mark Strickland and Lee Pritz at that Olympic qualifier in 2000. But again, you know, sometimes, like you said, there's writers you like, you just can't get through a certain book. Yep. But so for you, what's the time frame on this? When can they get to it? Quickest way to find this stuff for you?
Quickest way to find it is on the Kickstarter. The Kickstarter page is where all of my stuff right now lives, like this. And that's just till the end of next Thursday. After that, the Books of Jericho will go back on Kickstarter, or will go back on Amazon. We'll go back home, you know, and then, but for to keep things special for the people that back the Wolfstone books, those will not be on Amazon for probably 3 or 4 months. We will launch, if you miss the Kickstarter, we will launch an Indiegogo campaign to kind of pick up the stragglers that might have missed that. So if you did miss it and you still want to get on board, we'll have an Indiegogo link after that. But for the next 10 days, I'm not sure when the show gets released, but, you know, I believe, let me pull up the exact date so I don't screw this up. The 4th will be May 4th will be the last day that the Kickstarter campaign.
God, that is so nerdy of you. May the 4th be with you. Come on.
You believe it or not? It was a coincidence. That was a coincidence.
Right. I'm calling. I didn't even think about it. Full honky. You
know, like I say with my writing, sometimes things just work out. Sometimes things just fall right into place.
And in case you're wondering, again, go to Kickstarter.com. Easy way. Just type in the Wolfstone saga, and then it will pop right up. I know, because, you know, sometimes URLs can be a little tricky, but that's the way to do it. 10 days to go as we record this on April 25th. So the video will be out prior to the podcast. Audio will be out on the Short Time Wrestling Podcast here in the coming days. For right now, so JD Oliva, we talked, you know, half an hour on pro wrestling, half an hour on fantasy books and novels. And by the way, congratulations on the second place finish. Thanks. For DeKalb High School this year, the big schools in Illinois. So pretty solid wrestling state there. And then I guess the next time we'll see will be Fargo.
Yeah, looking forward to it, man. We got to catch up there, and hopefully Team Illinois can bring a decent squad. COVID absolutely decimated our freestyle and Greco programs. You know, the juniors last year were able to kind of, you know, still combat and fight hard. Our cadet group was really down. You know, I went to the freestyle state tournament this weekend, and, you know, we're getting better. You know, I think everybody's in the same spot. We got kids that basically in our state that missed off-season wrestling for the better part of 2 years, right? I see a lot of sloppy gut wrenches and leg laces, you know,
you got a lot of 2-on-1s though in that state. I mean, it's like, no matter what,
it's 2-on-1. We got Greco. We have Greco State this week. So we're pausing freestyle. We have 3 Greco practices. Man, I'll tell you something. You come to a DeKalb practice, you're going to see a lot of 2-on-1s. We're going to do a lot of 2-on-1s and arm drags. I am a Brian Medlin disciple, and I believe in our system as far as Greco goes.
What's also interesting about that cadet thing real quick is we figured it out. I mean, it was an obvious thing last year. We're back in Fargo. Well, wait a minute. Every single cadet wrestling has never wrestled in this tournament because the second year cadets couldn't come back because you got 2 years, and then, well, they're all first year cadets or they're second year cadets, and there was no tournament in 2020. So it's like weird.
This was weird.
Nobody's ever wrestled in this tournament before at the cadet age group. It was crazy.
And you watch the tournament. It looked like it. Right. Yeah. Like it was, especially the cadet level, it was, or U16 now level, it was real down. I think
I'm going to write 16U, but I'm still going to say
cadets. It's hard. I know. I still call them cadets. I'm on the dual team staff here again in Illinois. So we keep calling them cadets, even though they're U16.
I mean, we know what it is. Again, you have to write it that way, but it's like, it's one of those things. It's amateur wrestling. It's, you know, or is it college and Olympic? It's, you can say one thing and mean another.
It's weird. It's everything is U something or other until you get to juniors, and it's still juniors. I mean,
because juniors is high school.
I know.
You've got to be a junior. It's a high school age group. It's not an age group level. It's 9 through 12. You know, you cannot be in eighth grade and wrestle juniors.
It's so weird, man. But yeah, we're rebuilding in Illinois. We'll see where we're at come Fargo time. We establish our teams very early. So, you know, we're real good about getting the state team to work together. We have a great training camp, and that's my summer vacation every year. I spend a couple weeks with my buddies, and, you know, we're getting kids better at running and hitting gut wrenches. So hopefully we can keep on going with that.
And here's what I love. It's the battle between Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois with the social media battles, the t-shirts, the jawing, the shirts, like, you know, the Game of Thrones theme 1 year. Oh, yeah. It's like, I think Minnesota had Game of Thrones, and it's like, Illinois was Hodor. It's like, you know, nothing. It's cool to see when the adults, granted, it's all a game. It's all for fun, but it's very competitive. So I can't wait to see what Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois come up with in terms of the jawing on social media and in Fargo with the team shirts, because that's always some of the most fun. Is, all right, what's all right, Iowa, fellas, you want to jump into the conversation? Oh, you want to go with winners win? Let's see what we got. So
that was a fun one last year. I was entertained by that.
That was entertaining to everybody. Except
for
maybe Fellers.
Except I don't know. I love this stuff. Like, we're Pete Kowalczyk and I have been the Greco cadet coaches for a while, and you know, we have fun with the Minnesota guys, and it's always in good fun, right? Especially, you know, Minnesota and Iowa and Illinois. Like, it's fun, and it's a good time to go out to Fargo and catch up with people you haven't seen in a long time and just coach some wrestling for a week. And it's a blast, man. I'm so glad we got to do it last year. I'm even happier that we're gonna get to do it this year, and it's gonna feel more normal. Like, I'm gonna have a bunch of my own kids out there that are, you know, scrapping, trying to be all Americans and trying to be national champs. At DeKalb, I'm pretty proud to say that every year since 2017, we've had two kids in the finals. You know, I'm very proud of that. And, you know, hopefully we can keep that tradition going. So, you know, we got a good thing going here.
Solid. JD, you sound like you got a lot of good things going. So check out JD Oliva. Where can they find you on social if they want to keep up with what you're doing besides the Kickstarter?
Best place is at Twitter at JD underscore Oliva, O-L-I-V-A.
Right there on the screen. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy.
The Short Time Wrestling Podcast is proudly outfitted by Compound Sportswear. Shirts, singlets, custom gear orders, everything you need. Call up Cliff and the crew at cmpteamwear.com. Hey, you know what? Did you like the show? You want to hit that subscribe button? MattTalkOnline.com/listen. Various different ways to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcatcher of choice. And if you're already subscribed and you're already listening, you love the show and you want to support this show and this network, MattTalkOnline.com/join the team. Become a team member today.